Teenager versus Trump, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This high schooler is suing the U.S. government over climate change.
I've always really been into government, and taking action through the judicial branch sounded really interesting. So I was like, yeah, I'm down for that.
Also, big concerns about the Russian antivirus company Kaspersky Lab.
What really matters is if the technology platform can be used as a conduit for international espionage.
And how Vladimir Putin's view of American democracy went from bad to worse.
Democracy becomes the biggest swear word he can hear anybody utter. He builds grievances and resentments toward every president, and ultimately that manifests itself in Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State.
Those stories and a whole lot more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us. You know, every day I come to the newsroom, it strikes me. What happens in the U.S. matters across the globe, but also how events beyond our borders reverberate here. We deal with those links daily, and we kick off today's show with a great example of what I'm talking about. Kaspersky Lab. It's a Moscow-based antivirus company that you've probably heard of. In fact, your computer might even be running it. For decades, Kaspersky has faced questions about its relationship to the Russian government. Those questions have heated up in recent weeks after several U.S. news outlets reported that Russian hackers used Kaspersky software to steal classified information from the U.S.
It looks like to me this problem's been going on for 2 or 3 years. Frankly, I'm embarrassed.
That's Republican Roger Marshall of Kansas speaking during a congressional hearing on Kaspersky earlier today.
Even if it was just a potential problem, if it's a national security issue, we should have been fixing it yesterday, not tomorrow.
Among those testifying at that hearing, Sean Canuck. He's the director of Future Conflict and Cybersecurity at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. The central question seems to be whether Kaspersky knowingly complied with Russia. You testified today that regardless of whether or not they did, that using their antivirus software still poses a risk. Can you explain why?
Yes. For me as a strategic analyst, what really matters is if the technology platform can be used as a conduit for international espionage. I think the recent media reports of both Israeli and Russian actors either penetrating or exploiting Kaspersky technology platforms shows that it is vulnerable, and not only that it's vulnerable, but that it is a highly desired target for sovereign actors to penetrate.
And do you think that any antivirus software is safe when it comes to classified or sensitive information?
I think they're all at risk because we certainly have evidence of third-party compromises of platforms in other countries. So do I believe that European or North American software could also be a target of Russian or other intelligence services? Absolutely. The question is, would they be able to bring to bear the same resources on it as they would entities that are based in their home jurisdiction?
The Trump administration last month issued a directive banning Kaspersky software in federal agencies. I think our listeners might be wondering whether they should be using Kaspersky software. Is it risky?
That, to me, is going to be based on what your digital assets are and who you think might be trying to compromise them. If you don't think Russian actors would have an interest in the value of the data residing on your networks, then possibly not. If you think that that is a primary concern for your enterprise security, then you may want to take similar precautions.
As far as government use of this antivirus software, at today's hearing, did you or any of your cybersecurity colleagues or committee members mention any viable solutions to dealing with these risks?
Well, number one, I think everyone involved in the discussion today stressed the importance of the issue. Certainly, the two government witnesses spoke to the need for increased investment in this area and resources to fight these issues, and really the need to improve the resilience of one's own networks. We live in an era where nothing is perfectly secure, and the new normal is going to be continued cyber operations. So how do you increase the resilience of your own networks to defend and prevent against attacks, or at least be able to mitigate them when they do happen?
So despite the risks, there are other governments that continue to use the Kaspersky software. I mean, that's the case in Germany. What does it mean for U.S. cybersecurity when a U.S. ally continues to use a software that many experts say is risky?
So again, I think that's going to depend on the particular context. There may be some instances where it won't be a major concern if our allies are using it. But then certainly in a national security or a military context where you want to have interoperability between sensitive networks, certainly a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So I think that's possibly the context where these divergent policies would have to be revisited and thought about on a collective level.
Sean Canuck of the International Institute for Strategic Studies there. He testified today at the congressional hearing on the Russian antivirus company Kaspersky Lab. It seems that the U.S. and Russia are going nose to nose with each other on many fronts, diplomatic, political, military, and the man who is often portrayed at the center of it all, Russian President Vladimir Putin. Filmmaker Michael Kirk sees a pattern in Putin's behavior, which he lays out in a new two-part documentary, Putin's Revenge, which begins tonight on PBS Frontline. Let's have a quick listen to one scene early in the doc. It's the year 2000. President Boris Yeltsin is stepping down as president of Russia and has handed power to then-Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. President Bill Clinton goes to Moscow to meet the new leader. They don't hit it off. And later, Clinton tells the retired Boris Yeltsin about his meeting with Putin.
Bill Clinton looked hard into Yeltsin's eyes and said, "I'm a little bit concerned about this young man that you have turned over the presidency to. He doesn't have democracy in his heart." And he reached over and poked him in his heart. And I will never forget the expression that came over Yeltsin.
Yeltsin's confidants say by the end of his life, he would come to agree with Clinton.
Before Boris Yeltsin died, he told intimates that it was a great mistake for him to have selected Putin as his successor.
That's the voice of Strobe Talbot, who was Deputy Secretary of State at the time. So, Michael Kirk, what did Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin mistrust in Vladimir Putin in those early days?
I think some of it is he knew Putin's background. He knew KGB officer, knew that he was an unbelievable bureaucrat who could out-bureaucrat the other bureaucrats. So they have this man who's worked his way up through the bureaucracy very quickly to be prime minister. And I think Yeltsin thought Stalin was a great bureaucrat. This guy's a great bureaucrat. And I think Clinton especially sensed it immediately. This is an arrogant, tough guy who's not going to follow the rules.
So what is Putin's game? What does he want from the U.S.?
I think in the beginning it was to make Russia great again. And I think he really wanted to believe that the United States and he could be partners in those ways that he needed us to be. But what really happens to him is that he begins to notice from what he sees the very beginning of his relationship with George W. Bush, regime change is at the heart of the American democracy movement all over the world. Democracy becomes the biggest swear word he can hear anybody utter. He builds grievances and resentments toward every president, and ultimately that manifests itself in Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State.
So you begin the film talking about the 2016 election and Russian meddling. Obviously, it's a, you know, the big headline and the connection to Russia right now. But we learn that Putin saw it as a response to U.S. support for pro-democracy groups in Russia, culminating in those protests in 2011. Was Putin onto something? Were we meddling in Russia?
Well, I mean, if you talk to, as I did, every U.S. ambassador, the heads of the intelligence agencies, the CIA, the Department of Homeland Security, and Jim Clapper, the DNI at the time, and Toria Nuland especially, who was our ambassador to Europe and then very much involved in the Ukraine story, Of course we were there. Of course we were doing things through NGOs and others and election monitoring groups that we were helping to fund. We were in there stirring things up. There's no doubt that that's what we do, and that's where we were. And there's no doubt that he was right about some of that. But the parts he wasn't right about, see, Putin, the people we talked to in Russia, said Putin does not believe in spontaneous popular uprisings. He believes they have to be funded. People have to be pushed out into the Maidan in Ukraine and other places all over the color revolutions. And he needed to believe that we were there. He needed America to be the other side for his own domestic politics.
And now this hacking scandal that some believe was so engineered to prevent Hillary Clinton from getting to the White House. Do you believe that in Putin's mind there was a connection between those pro-democracy protests that Hillary Clinton he associates with in Russia?
Absolutely. When he's sitting there looking at 100,000 people just outside the Kremlin in 2011 and in 2012 after the sort of really rigged elections for the parliament in Russia in 2011. Lots of video proof. Really, for the first time ever, people are using their cell phones to show ballot box stuffing and other things. Clinton makes a statement as part of an election NGO or an election monitoring group that Russians have a right to a fair election. It's not exactly controversial statements, but it was enough that when it played on the web, he thinks she's the one. She's fomenting the revolution. And he remembers what her husband said to Boris Yeltsin and says, I see the conspiracy. It's regime change. They've paid these 100,000 people to come out on the streets. They're after me. I'm the next Gaddafi, Mubarak, Saddam. And she is at the heart of it all. And someday she's going to be president of the United States. I think I should do something about this.
How easy was it to find people in Russia who would speak really candidly, really openly about Putin?
But we did 30 hours worth of interviews with people who were willing to come forward. I also wanted people who were supporters of Putin. It gave us a flavor, at least. I'm not saying it's absolutely positively locked down, but some of the reporters we talked to over there are absolutely as plugged in as you can be and still be functioning in that society. We ran a lot of what we thought and where we were getting it through their filters and sort of trying to figure it all out. And I think that's what it is. It's a 20 or 30,000 foot view of his life, his motivation. The first hour is really, why did he do it? And the second hour is, how did he do it? And we think it works to help people understand exactly what that story is.
You can see part one of the Frontline documentary, Putin's Revenge, tonight on PBS stations. Director Michael Kirk, thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
Let's get in one more story before the break. Anne Frank and soccer seem pretty incongruous, but there's one pro soccer team in Rome whose fans, sadly, have forced a connection. The team is Lazio, and its hardcore fans have a reputation for racist and anti-Semitic behavior. Last Sunday, they lived up to that ugly reputation by defacing Rome's Olympic Stadium with anti-Semitic messages, including stickers that depicted Anne Frank dressed in the soccer jersey of a rival team. The stickers, which were meant as an insult, prompted widespread condemnation all over Italy. Lazio's owner responded by placing a wreath outside a synagogue in Rome. He also blamed a few idiots for what happened. Our colleagues at the BBC asked reporter Tancredi Palmieri about that. He's with Be In Sport.
There is this hardcore group of Lazio fans. We are talking about some few hundreds, but it's always about them. I mean, it's always about this group that are news of anti-Semitic, of racist, of neo-fascist initiative that happens, because it's not the first time that it happens.
Italian police have used the stadium's closed-circuit TV footage to identify 16 people involved in what happened on Sunday. Some are just teenagers, and now they all may be facing lifetime stadium bans. But Italy's Jewish community and many others wanted a stronger response, and Italian soccer authorities agreed. So today, ahead of every professional soccer game that was played in Italy, including Lazio's, all the teams observed a minute of silence to remember the victims of the Holocaust. And these words from Anne Frank's diary were read over the stadium loudspeakers.
Vedo il mondo mutarsi lentamente in un deserto.
I see the world being slowly transformed into a wilderness. I hear the approaching thunder that one day will destroy us too. I feel the suffering of millions. And yet, when I look up at the sky, I somehow feel that everything will change for the better, that this cruelty too shall end, that peace and tranquility will return once more.
A passage from Anne Frank's diary read over stadium loudspeakers at every pro soccer match today in Italy. Coming up, the teenager who is suing the Trump administration over climate change. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to the world. The United States and Syria, those are now the only two countries that are not going to be part of the Paris Climate Accord. Nicaragua, which had been the third holdout, has now announced it will sign the agreement. The world's environment reporter Carolyn Beeler is with me to discuss all this. So why did Nicaragua not join from the start?
So back in 2015 in Paris, Nicaragua's lead negotiator, Paul Oquist, said that they didn't want to join for two reasons. The agreement didn't do enough and it wasn't fair because all countries were expected to cut their carbon emissions, even though the big industrial nations really did the most in terms of causing the problem of climate change.
Yeah, so what changed that made them flip and sign on?
The country's position seems to have changed from this is an imperfect document, we're not going to sign it, to this is all we've got and something is better than nothing. President Daniel Ortega said they were signing on primarily in solidarity with countries on the front lines of climate change, referencing the increased cost in life and property of increasing natural disasters. People within the international climate diplomacy circles say this is evidence that the Paris Climate Agreement really is gaining in momentum, and that Nicaragua wanted to be on the right side of history on this one.
Give us some background here. What is Nicaragua's record on the environment?
So Nicaragua has invested heavily in renewable energy. About half of its energy currently comes from renewable sources, and the government wants to up that to roughly 90% by 2020. But in other areas, the country's environmental record is a lot more mixed. Deforestation is a huge issue there. Not everyone has access to clean drinking water, and agricultural issues like nitrogen runoff is also a big issue in this country. And the country has faced international criticism for being willing to build a giant canal through the country that would dramatically alter the environment there. That's a project we don't know if it's going to happen or not, but it's led a lot of critics to say that the president, Daniel Ortega, sort of talks a big game when it comes to protecting the environment, but really isn't putting those words into action in his own country.
The world's Carolyn Beeler there. As far as the U.S., don't hold your breath on President Trump changing his mind about the Paris climate deal. The administration's commitment to rolling back efforts to fight climate change, it is abundantly clear. Polls suggest most Americans disagree with that shift, but there's not much they can do about it really until the next presidential election. There's at least one group, though, that isn't willing to wait that long. They filed a lawsuit to force the administration to take action on the climate crisis. It's a novel effort with an unusual group of plaintiffs. Ashley Ahern of the podcast Terrestrial has this profile of one of them.
Victoria Barrett was really looking forward to her high school's retreat junior year. But she got there late, right in the middle of the talent show, and in no mood to party.
I'm in a room like full of screaming, dancing girls, and I can't, like, I was like, does nobody know what's happening in the world? Like, how is anyone happy right now? Like, how is anyone having a good time?
Victoria wasn't feeling the vibe that night because she'd just come from the United Nations, where she'd been talking about the lawsuit she's involved in to try to force the federal government to take action on climate change. It's called Juliana versus the United States, and it was filed by 21 young Americans between the ages of 10 and 21. They claim that the government is violating their constitutional rights by supporting the use of fossil fuels that are the biggest source of climate pollution. It's an unprecedented lawsuit. Some legal experts have called it radical. Victoria just calls it necessary.
It's an issue of justice and fairness.
Warming temperatures, rising seas, and more extreme weather threaten the lives of America's young people. But Victoria says they've had virtually no voice in deciding what's to be done about it. So when one of the organizers of an environmental group she was involved in suggested she join the lawsuit, Victoria jumped at the chance.
It seemed like another way to make change. And I've always really been into government, and taking action through the judicial branch sounded really interesting. So I was like, yeah, I'm down for that.
And there's an even deeper resonance for her. Victoria's mom is from Honduras, and developing countries like that are in the crosshairs of the climate crisis.
Sea level rise really impacts the coasts of Honduras, but, you know, they're not the ones contributing mostly to the issue. It's an issue of justice and fairness, and, you know, the people who are contributing the least amount of carbon emissions to the world are the ones being most affected by it.
But being from Honduras, her mom was concerned about Victoria getting involved in a lawsuit against the government.
In a country like Honduras, suing the government is like, you don't do that. Like, that is not an option. You could tell, like, maybe she thought the CIA or FBI was going to be watching me or something. She just seemed very, you don't think this could be bad for you or anything? And I was like, no, this sounds awesome.
Victoria's mom eventually came around, but others have been harder to convince, like her dad.
He's skeptical as to how severe of an issue it is.
Victoria's dad is a big fan of conservative talk radio. She grew up hearing Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh in the car, and he doesn't think climate change is that big of a deal.
He thinks that some of the rhetoric around it is just inflammatory and wants to make people scared. And I think my dad is really smart. I just think that he's wrong about this specific issue.
Victoria says she and her dad have had a lot of hard conversations about climate change. But ultimately, she says he respects the fact that she's doing research and taking action against what she sees as inequality. This is a pretty novel case. Victoria and her fellow plaintiffs claim that the federal government is violating the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. That's the one that says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The lawyers representing her and the other plaintiffs will argue that the government knew about the dangerous effects of burning fossil fuels and put the lives of citizens at risk by allowing companies to mine coal and drill for oil on public lands. And they'll ask the courts to require the federal government to commit to reducing CO2 levels in the atmosphere. I talked to one legal scholar who said this case is leaps and bounds ahead of where constitutional law has ever gone before, and there's not much chance it'll succeed. Others say it empowers the judicial branch and the courts to overstep their bounds and essentially determine national climate policy. And Victoria says the critiques go even further.
A lot of people think that we were put up to this, brainwashed, because we're kids. Apparently kids can't have, like, autonomous ideas or feelings.
She says she's fully aware of what she's getting into. She's been trolled on the internet, as have some of the other plaintiffs. She's missed school because of her involvement with the case, and she struggled to keep her grades up and try to balance that with a social life and hobbies.
It's not like I don't want to have to do this. It's just I feel like it obviously needs to be done. Like, young people need to be speaking about this issue because other people aren't dealing with it to the extent that they really should be. It's frustrating to think about the fact that sometimes I feel like people my age are fighting the hardest when really, like, we didn't even start this in the first place.
There's a long legal slog ahead. The Trump administration has asked to have the case dismissed, and there's a ruling expected on that any day. But win or lose, Victoria says the lawsuit is sending an important message.
Letting other young people all over the country know that you don't have to be able to vote to make political change. There's a lot of actions that you can take, and there's a lot of power that you have as a young person that shouldn't be wasted.
This fall, Victoria is a freshman at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she plans to study environmental and political science. For The World, I'm Ashley Ahern.
News headlines are next, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The European Parliament was set to debate the issue of sexual harassment today, and the first step was taking a long look at its own problems.
We all heard the stories and rumors that are going on for many years. The very place that claims to legislate against this sort of disgusting behavior is turning a blind eye to its practice.
That story is still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. How does a city respond after it experiences a brutal hate crime that puts it in the international spotlight? 5 months ago, two white men were killed on a light rail train in Portland while they were protecting two black women. One of the women was wearing a hijab. As The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, the city's leaders learned that moving forward meant reckoning with the past.
On the day of the light rail murders, the mayor of Portland was on a flight to London, so the chair of the city council was in charge. That was Chloe Udaly, an independent bookseller who was just 5 months into her new job as commissioner.
I was out with a friend just kind of decompressing after work when my phone started ringing and, you know, from her little convertible at Cathedral Park, I was talking to people on two different phones.
In Portland, four commissioners and the mayor directly run the city. There's no city administrator. It's the last big city in America to do things that way. And critics say that's what's kept the city council from becoming more diverse. Udaly's white, but she's the rare commissioner elected from a more diverse area of the city.
Progressiveness coupled with a lack of diversity is one of our problems. The majority of the white residents here have been blissfully unaware of how hostile the city can be to people of color.
She says that's because few white residents are exposed to people of color. Portland's the whitest big city in America. After the murders, there were vigils and community meetings, but the city council's principal response was a one-time allocation of $350,000 to fund anti-hate programs. UDaily's staff had recommended city commissioners allocate more than $2 million.
Have we done enough? Absolutely not. But have we made progress in the right direction? Yes. We are having conversations now about our city that were not happening on any kind of large scale 15, 20, 30 years ago.
But those are small steps to undo more than 100 years of history. The state's original constitution banned black people. It was illegal for African Americans to move into the state until the mid-1920s. And the KKK was rampant.
The KKK was institutional. I mean, the KKK ran police departments in the state of Oregon in the 1920s. It ran the mayor. We had a governor who was basically elected by the Klan.
Randy Blazak is head of the Oregon Coalition Against Hate Crimes, a partnership of community groups and government agencies.
It was a civil organization. Like, you know, you joined the Lions Club or the Kiwanis or something, and you had the Klan. It was sort of that open.
The coalition gives bus tours of Portland's racist past. They stop at the Portland Expo Center, where thousands of Japanese Americans lived before being shipped to federal internment camps. The tour visits the riverbank, where a mostly African American city was allowed to wash away in a flood. There's also a stop at the intersection where white skinheads used a bat to beat Ethiopian immigrant Mulugeta Sarah to death in 1988.
Then we end up at a restaurant called Clyde's Prime Rib that in the 40s was called the Coon Chicken Inn. And it was a big caricature of an African-American face that you walk through to get into the front door, yeah.
It was long gone by the time Blazak arrived here in the 1990s. He was a young researcher, driven to study white supremacist groups after growing up white in what he describes as a Georgia Klan town.
I was a kid who wrote an essay for my journalism class. We had to write an editorial, and my editorial was, if they have Black History Month, why don't we have White History Month?
He's been making up for doing things like that ever since by trying to understand white hate groups. He says the white supremacist groups in Oregon now recruit a lot in prisons, but they're less structured than in the past. There's more of a leaderless resistance model where people check in on websites instead of belonging to a formal organization. Blazak says that makes them harder to track and combat.
We've often tried to encourage people to not use the notion of a white supremacist movement because it's not really moving anywhere and there's a lot of tension and conflict within it. It's more of a white supremacist counterculture. So it's not really a unified movement as much as what I like to think of as a bunch of knuckleheads.
Representatives of the Portland anti-fascist group Rose City Antifa are trying to document and track the movements of those people Blazak calls knuckleheads. Antifa says those white supremacists can't be dismissed because they're on a path of increasing violence. They point to Jeremy Christian, the alleged murderer of the two men on the light rail. A month before the deaths, he participated in a march where he was videotaped giving a Nazi Sieg Heil salute. The organizer of that event, and many others up and down the West Coast, was Joey Gibson, a 33-year-old real estate investor who says he became an activist during the election.
I realize that we have a big problem culturally. We're being trained to dehumanize people. All you have to do is say they're racist or say they're this or say they're that, and then all of a sudden the mob comes out of nowhere and like they justify assaulting you, dehumanizing you.
Gibson's half Japanese, half white. He denies he's a white supremacist, and he even denounces them. His purpose, he says, is to draw attention to violent people on the left, like Antifa.
I want to show liberals that we are not the violent ones, we're not the hateful ones, and you need to disavow and distance yourselves from these far left, this alt-left protesters, just like we have to distance ourselves from the alt-right.
Portland officials have tried to shut down at least one of Gibson's rallies in the city unsuccessfully. So they've adopted a broader strategy to be vocal and consistent about condemning hate. On a recent Sunday, Mayor Ted Wheeler wore sneakers and a hoodie to address a few hundred people at a city rally in a downtown park. Leaves floated down on the audience of a few hundred, mostly brown and black people.
All of us feel a responsibility to condemn racism, intolerance, hatred, the goal of all of which are to divide and to oppress.
Leaders vowed to combat hate and white supremacy as institutional problems, not just isolated incidents carried out by a few mentally unstable people. The local county chair, Deborah Kafouri, said she'd heard about discrimination from her own staff of color.
We had a very painful and emotional and raw board meeting. We heard from employees and community how racism and oppression show up in our workplace. And we voted to pass the first workforce equity resolution in our county's history.
But many people of color I talked to remain skeptical, like the Reverend Joseph Santos Lyons of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, or APANO. He's Chinese American, and he also spoke at the rally, striking a very different tone from other speakers.
We're watching you. I'm actually not here to validate your event. We at APANO will do our best to be partners when we can, and sometimes we're going to disagree. But what I do appreciate is you make space for us at the table. I think that is a new tradition that we need to continue.
But the question now is how to get everyone on board with the new tradition and the commitment to defy Portland's racist past. Earlier this year, the mayor put out a job description for a new police chief that said Portland was looking for someone who could address the city's history of legally enforced systemic racism. And the police union president was offended. He said the mayor had angered and frustrated rank-and-file officers by disregarding decades of progress.
The police bureau is a really tough nut to crack.
This is Commissioner Chloe Udaly.
Councils have given away a lot of power. We have a very powerful police union. Although I appreciate the work the police do, I'm frustrated by certain issues we're facing with our bureau and how hard it seems to make real change.
We talked to the police union president and other people of color in Portland about how to move forward tomorrow. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy in Portland.
The global outcry over the Harvey Weinstein scandals made one thing clear. Sexual harassment isn't just an American problem. And on this matter, today the European Parliament was forced to take a long look at itself. The online publication Politico Europe has collected more than 30 allegations of rape, assault, and harassment linked to the Parliament. British member of the European Parliament Margot Parker did not hold back this morning.
We all heard the stories and rumours that are going on for many years. The very place that claims to legislate against this sort of disgusting behaviour is turning a blind eye to its practice. The idea that MEPs or staff are using their positions of power to perpetrate abuse is shameful and unacceptable.
And Sweden's Cecilia Malmström, the European Commissioner for Trade, was outraged.
Enough. This is enough. We refuse to be silent. We refuse to accept. We must continue to work towards eradicating this problem.
Ryan Heath is a reporter for Politico Europe. How much of this conversation in the European Parliament was prompted by the Weinstein scandal and the Me Too social media campaign?
A significant amount of it was. We've been hearing stories and trying to report them through a podcast I do for about 5 months, but it's been very difficult to get people to go on the record. And the Weinstein scandal really was a tipping point, you might say. It gave people more confidence to say that they could come forward with their stories. And once we had a European commissioner go on the record and say that she had been a victim of sexual assault, then the floodgates started to open.
So you actually started this investigation prior to the Weinstein scandal. What prompted that?
Well, I was initially tipped off to some complaints about senior members of the European Parliament nearly a year ago now, and I wasn't able to verify them to the extent we needed to publish those stories. But it made me realize, hang on, there's a problem. Then we started an advice section of the podcast that we run. And through that anonymous forum, we were able to realize, wow, there's a really deep vein of information here that we haven't fully gotten into. And from that, that's where we got these now 140 stories.
What are the European Parliament's policies when it comes to sexual harassment?
Well, they actually have quite strong policies. It's not the written words that are the problem. It's the cultural practices around them. What it tends to do is focus a little bit too much on the people who tend to have power in the situation already, the members of the parliament, and it doesn't quite do enough to help people who are the most vulnerable, the young staff, the staff on the temporary contracts, and so on. When you have elected members of parliament who have these special privileges like immunity from prosecution, you know, it's a really tricky power dynamic.
We now have a much clearer idea of what the culture is like in Hollywood, a lot of powerful men. How many women are there in the European Parliament? Is there a culture there that suggests there could be some traction for change?
So there are several thousand women working in the European Parliament. So they're not quite half, but it's not far off it. It tends to be men in the more senior positions. And you have a situation where it's 28 different national cultures coming together. So people approach some of these issues differently. Mm. And many of the staff come and go from Brussels and Strasbourg in France back to their home country. So there's an element of we're on holiday. So you've got that sort of party atmosphere going on as well. And then, of course, people have party loyalties, things they wouldn't accept outside of their political environment. You know, they suddenly find is a blurred line and they don't judge it the same way that they would if their mother or their sister or their friend came to them with that same story back at home.
We are two men talking about sexual harassment. Who are the people taking up this cause in Brussels? Is it just women, women and men?
It's a real mix. In a debate today in the European Parliament, it was mostly female MEPs who were doing the talking. I think that it's interesting that so few men thought to have the responsibility to take a view in that debate. I think the discussion that I've been having, most of the people coming to me to have the discussion are women as well. But I felt a responsibility to not lead that discussion, but definitely facilitate it. Because the role I have in the Brussels community is that a lot of people read my column each morning. It's a place where people come together to discuss European politics. And so if this is what people are talking about in the bars and the cafes, then I want to make sure that people who are perpetrating these acts or people who are in charge of administering the response to the acts, that they are forced to have that discussion as well.
Sexual harassment, we also know, is a systemic problem, which means this is probably not confined to the European Parliament. Have other organizations in the European Union responded?
You're 100% correct. And I think people in the Parliament were a bit frustrated with me today for my particular focus on some rape allegations that were made by staff members at the European Parliament, because they felt that the focus was just on them. But actually, 80%, so 4 out of every 5 stories that have been told to me, they're not in the European Parliament. Around about 40% are in the private sector. About 20% are from non-government organizations, advocacy groups, and so on. And then the rest are from different institutions in the European Union. And then we'll need to take time to reflect that full picture when we report out the rest of the stories.
Ryan Heath, a reporter for Politico Europe, thanks very much for being with us.
A pleasure.
A quick note before the break about none other than Albert Einstein. Einstein was a smart guy, had lots of scientific theories. That one on relativity, priceless. But Einstein also had some views on how to live a good life. And if E equals MC squared is priceless, we can actually put a dollar figure on how much Einstein's life advice is worth. Let me explain here. In 1922, just after learning he'd won the Nobel Prize, Einstein happened to be on a lecture tour in Japan. A courier delivered a letter to his hotel. Either Einstein didn't have any small change or the courier refused a tip. The point is this. Instead of cash, the courier got a handwritten note from Einstein. It reads, "A quiet and modest life brings more joy than a pursuit of success bound with constant unrest." And yes, it's got Einstein's signature on it. Einstein allegedly told the courier, "This may be worth more than a tip someday." Mm-hmm. Because yesterday, an auction house in Jerusalem put up Einstein's note for sale. Auctioneer Gal Wiener was expecting significant interest.
Einstein is a worldwide personality. So when Albert Einstein writes a few words from a deep thought of his heart, what is the secret of happy living, this is something that interests everyone and can talk to everyone.
Bidding started at $2,000 and 20 minutes of frantic bidding later.
So Albert Einstein for $1,300,000. Take off!
I don't know if you caught that. $1,300,000. I guess when it comes to the value of a life well lived, it's all relative. Mexicans everywhere are preparing for the annual Day of the Dead celebrations. The holiday is very important in the southern state of Oaxaca, but many residents there are not feeling so festive this year. They're still recovering from a major earthquake that struck last month, killing nearly 100 people and damaging thousands of buildings. Shannon Young has our story.
Children sing the national anthem as bulldozers prepare to rake at what was the largest school in the Isthmus region of Oaxaca. There's some crying, too, among the adults here. This building was one of many local landmarks severely damaged by the 8.2 magnitude earthquake last month. Local architect Claudina de Gives says the transformation of the landscape has been dramatic.
It's a shock, for starters, because it's like seeing part of your identity disappear. Many things contribute to identity. It's not just language, clothing, and food. It's also urban surroundings.
Hello.
Demolition crews paid for by the government have been bulldozing homes by the hundreds. That includes structures that were initially assessed as only partly damaged. Mariano Lopez of the Juchitán People's Assembly says the contractors have been pressuring residents to report their damaged homes as total losses. This allows for faster demolition and makes homeowners eligible for more government rebuilding aid.
They tell them, we have a week to clear this block, and if we don't demolish your house now, we aren't coming back. So they rush people, and they don't give them time to recover windowsills or doors or any other materials that could be reused.
The government has praised the speed of the demolitions as proof it's moving forward on rebuilding and recovery. Lopez says the more homes the crews tear down, the more money they make. Many of the demolished homes were over a century old, built in a distinct regional style with adobe, hardwood beams, and clay roofing tiles. For Chilean architect Patricio Mora, executive director of Proyecto Memoria, it's a familiar scenario, something he witnessed after an 8.8 earthquake hit his country in 2010.
Lamentablemente, las personas, por un tema de desconfianza con sus viviendas de adobe, las comenzaron a demoler.
He says people in Chile demolished historic homes out of panic or due to bad advice from first responders. Mora came to Oaxaca at the invitation of the Casa de la Ciudad, an urban planning nonprofit where the Jivas works. And Mora has some advice for those in the hard-hit areas.
The
first thing is to stay calm. Don't rush to demolish a building on a tight deadline without, for example, authorities understanding that adobe can be restored. That's fundamental.
Some families and local groups have been carrying out controlled demolitions, salvaging whole bricks, wooden beams, and clay tiles. Mora says the fact that many of the older homes in Oaxaca's Isthmus region were built with adobe improves their prospects for repair.
El adobe tiene esa propiedad de ser
adobe has certain versatile properties. If a piece is destroyed, the damaged part can be removed and mixed with water and restored. It is flexible, and when combined with wooden framework, is earthquake resistant.
But there's a gap when it comes to formal training and use of traditional materials. Architecture schools, even in places like Oaxaca, where earthen construction is common, tend to teach students more about building with concrete and steel than with adobe and clay. Despite its resilience, adobe carries a certain stigma in Mexico because it's seen as a building material for the poor. Claudina de Gives studied architecture at Oaxaca State University. She says she'd like to see this crisis result in greater appreciation for and formal training in traditional or vernacular architecture.
Oaxaca is one of the state's richest in vernacular architectural heritage, so there's even more reason its schools should encourage knowledge about these traditional systems.
A big question now is just what the region will look like once the rebuilding begins. The federal government has activated an emergency response fund and is distributing electronic gift cards to those who have agreed to home demolition. The cards can be used to purchase about $6,300 worth of building materials, but only at large, qualifying hardware stores. Small-scale operations like self-employed adobe brickmakers have been left out of the government-subsidized rebuilding loop. For The World, Shannon Young, Oaxaca, Mexico.
Earlier on the show, we were talking about Russia and Vladimir Putin, and given some sad news we heard when we got to the newsroom this morning, I'd be remiss if I didn't play this.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. On Blueberry Hill. When I found you.
Vladimir Putin singing Blueberry Hill. The song was the biggest hit for Fats Domino, who died yesterday at the age of 89. The song was so associated with American rock and roll that it became its own distinct export. Fats and Blueberry Hill were American rock and roll, and it seemed the rest of the globe wanted a piece.
I found my thrill.
This is Yellow Man from Jamaica.
On Blueberry Hill. I fell my thrill.
Italy's Adriano Celentano.
On Blueberry Hill. You'll find me in there.
And from the 70s, a popular Swedish singer, Jan Harpo Svensson.
When love shows, you don't break the rules.
Fats Domino was born in 1928, a true child of New Orleans. His parents were Antoine Caliste Domino and Marie Donatille Gros, French Creole, a culture that grew up around the descendants of mixed-race people with roots in France and Africa. So what music was Fats Domino listening to when he was a kid? Our partners at Smithsonian pointed us to this song called Dixieland by Frémont and Ray Fontenot. In 2005, when Hurricane Katrina hit his city, Fats Domino was 77. Age was slowing his career down, but he reemerged after the storm to help others in New Orleans who had suffered more than he did. One of the last times Fats sang Blueberry Hill was for a cameo appearance in the HBO series Tremé.
I can't sing opera.
The character played by Steve Zahn goes to speak with Fats about starring in a New Orleans opera.
All about Katrina and everything that's happened since. It's all done in New Orleans style that you pioneered. A rhythm and blues opera with you as the headliner.
At the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. On Blueberry Hill. When I was drinking beer. The monster still.
PRI, Public Radio International.